Good evening. I don't know, I'm not sure I can remember when I first met Ira and Barbara Lynn or Sister Helen Bowen-Barker. But isn't it amazing how God has so tied our hearts together that when you see somebody that you have just a wonderful connection and memories with, that how it resurrects in you, how it brings back in you both thoughts about the worst of yourself and the best of yourself, and the goodness of God, the grace of God through all of that. I can't say anything more about these folks other than the fact that I love you. Because if I say any more than that, then I'm just going to be a blubbering mess. And you all didn't come to hear me cry tonight. But I'm just so grateful, I mean genuinely grateful to God for the ties that bind us together as His people. And I know that I'm going to feel about you guys after this week the way that I feel about them, and I'm just thankful for the family that we have, because we have such a good Father. I invite you to turn tonight to Daniel chapter 6, if you will. Daniel chapter 6. And I want to read together, beginning in verse 1 of this wonderful context. Daniel chapter 6, verse 1. It seemed good to Darius to appoint 120 satraps over the kingdom, that they should be in charge of the whole kingdom, and over them three commissioners, of whom Daniel was one, that these satraps might be accountable to them, and that the king might not suffer loss. Then this Daniel began distinguishing himself among the commissioners and satraps, because he possessed an extraordinary spirit, and the king planned to appoint him over the entire kingdom. Then the commissioners and the satraps began trying to find a ground of accusation against Daniel in regard to government affairs. But they could find no ground of accusation or evidence of corruption, inasmuch as he was faithful, and no negligence or corruption was to be found in him. Then these men said, "We shall not find any ground of accusation against this Daniel unless we find it against him with regard to the law of his God." Then these commissioners and satraps came by agreement to the king and spoke to him as follows, "King Darius, live forever. All the commissioners of the kingdom, the prefects and the satraps, the high officials and the governors, have consulted together that the king should establish a statute and enforce an injunction that anyone who makes a petition to any god or man besides you, O king, for 30 days, shall be cast into the lion's den. Now, O king, establish the injunction and sign the document so that it may not be changed according to the law of the Medes and Persians, which may not be revoked." Therefore, King Darius signed the document, that is, the injunction. Now, when Daniel knew that the document was signed, he entered his house. Now in his roof chamber, he had windows open toward Jerusalem. And he continued kneeling on his knees three times a day, praying and giving thanks before his God, as he had been doing previously. Then these men came by agreement and found Daniel making petition and supplication before his God. And they approached and spoke before the king about the king's injunction. "Did you not sign an injunction that any man who makes a petition to any god or man besides you, O king, for 30 days is to be cast into the lion's den?" The king answered and said, "The statement is true, according to the law of the Medes and Persians, which may not be revoked. Then they answered and said, Daniel, who's one of the exiles from Judah, pays no attention to you, O king, or to the injunction which you signed, but keeps making his petition three times a day. Then as soon as the king heard this statement, he was deeply distressed and set his mind on delivering Daniel. And even until sunset, he kept exerting himself to rescue him. And so these men came by agreement to the king and said to the king, recognize, O king, that it's a law of the Medes and Persians that no injunction or statute which the king establishes may be changed. And so the king gave orders, and Daniel was brought in and cast into the lion's den. And the king spoke and said to Daniel, your God whom you constantly serve will himself deliver you. Yet a stone was brought and laid over the mouth of the den. And the king sealed it with his own signet ring and with the signet rings of his nobles, so that nothing might be changed in regard to Daniel. And then the king went off to his palace and spent the night fasting, and no entertainment was brought before him, and his sleep fled from him. There's a lot we could say about the character of this man, Daniel, and how he approached this momentous crisis in his life. We could certainly talk about his faith, how courageous it was. We could certainly talk about his character, and we're going to say some things about that tonight, as well as about his faith. But the phrase that I want us to think about tonight as we examine this man and this crisis in his life and in the history of this government that he was serving at that time is his, what I've called his uncompromising devotion. I want you to think about that phrase for just a little bit and what that means to you. Uncompromising devotion. A commitment to God that is unflagging, that won't change, that isn't moved by externals, that doesn't change with culture, that doesn't give in to the pressure of peers. But a commitment to God, a devotion to God that will stand by itself if need be, even when we are the target of personal harm or loss. Uncompromising devotion. We're going to look a little more closely at just how that's manifested in Daniel's life, but I want to give a warning before we look more closely at this text. This is not just a children's story. I mean, this is for us. This is a picture of what faith looks like. It's a picture of what the kind of disciple that God's word and God's promises and God's character is calculated to produce. This is the kind of life and heart that our God is worthy of, what we see modeled in Daniel here in this text. And so if we go away from having read and understood Daniel chapter 6, and all we do is admire the man, then we've missed the point of the text. This story is not written for our admiration. This text is written for our imitation. It's not enough for us just to laud and applaud and to praise men of faith like Daniel. I mean, we are to follow in their footsteps. And so I want us to get that before we go into the text tonight, that if we have understood what we see here in Daniel, then this is the way for us to behave. This is an example that's given for us not to adulate, but for us to imitate. And so let's think about that carefully as we begin to look a little more carefully at what at the kind of life that Daniel and devotion that Daniel modeled for us. I want to ask you this question. Do we have a reputation for moral excellence? Do we have a reputation for moral excellence? I want you to see that that's one of the things that defined Daniel's uncompromising devotion. The king has, King Darius has selected 120 satraps, men who have distinguished themselves, whom he's given responsibility in his government. And Daniel excelled among those 120. So that there are three commissioners that have been appointed over the 120 satraps, and Daniel is one of those three. And Daniel has even so distinguished himself among the three that Darius is entertaining putting Daniel in charge of everything. Now, I know it's the case that Daniel was extraordinarily gifted. I mean, he had great skill. He had great wisdom. He distinguished himself in that way when he was first taken into captivity by Nebuchadnezzar the king, when he was brought in as an orphan and served the Babylonian government and now has come to serve the Persian government as well. So I know that he's extraordinarily gifted, but I want you to see that it's more than just the fact that he's a very gifted and very talented and very sharp man. I know he has great skill, but he's a man who's distinguished by his character as well. I mean, he's a man that... It wouldn't be so much to celebrate if he was a gifted man, but he just buried his talents. If he was a gifted man, but he didn't do his best. We find that he did both. He was gifted, but he rose to the potential that God had given him, and he utilized that potential in service. And I tell you what's even more admirable than that is that he served a government who had destroyed his people, a government who had taken him captive, a government that was really that was really an enemy to him, and yet he saw that had been the purpose of God, that Israel would go into captivity, that it was the purpose of God that they spend those 70 years there, that it was the purpose of God that he be in the position and the place where he was. And he was content with where God put him and to do the best that he could to have the right kind of heart in that kind of position. And he distinguishes himself here because of the fact that he was a man of moral excellence. Could I ask you this question? I mean, should that not be the case with the people of God? I mean, shouldn't it be the case that if we're on the team, or if we're a part of the... If we're a part of the company, or whatever the work is that's assigned to us, whatever it is that we're a part of, that we are a people who do our best, who have a servant heart, who are people who are honest and trustworthy and reliable, who are a people who practice kindness, who are people who practice gentleness, who are people that when we have a load, or when we have a burden, or when we have a responsibility, we are happy to carry that. We are happy to fulfill our mission that we're given. I mean, should it not be that we are the best kind of neighbors and the best kind of citizens and the best kind of employees and the best people to work for? Should that not just be the case for the people of God? Certainly it should. And so one of the marks of an uncompromising devotion is that we are a people who practice moral excellence. But there's another dimension to that Daniel models for us. And that is not just the fact that he was a man who distinguished himself for his moral excellence. It's that all the people around him not only knew the what's about Daniel, the how's about Daniel and his behavior, they knew the why. They knew the why. Everybody knew why Daniel was the way that he was. Could I ask you this question? Do the people around us know our why? Look at what they said about Daniel when they examined his character. It says that in verse 4, that the commissioners and the satraps began trying to find a ground of accusation against against Daniel in regard to government affairs. But they could find no ground of accusation or evidence of corruption, inasmuch as he was faithful and no negligence or corruption was to be found in him. I mean, they looked for some dirt on Daniel. And please be advised that Daniel was not serving a government that had on their dollar bills "In God We Trust." I mean, the Persians believed they were pagans. They believed in many gods. They were not monotheists. And they didn't believe, they were not believers in Jehovah. And so that's the kind of government that Daniel is serving. And yet here is a man that is serving a pagan government, and yet he is doing that with moral character. They can't find any corruption in him. And not only is that the case, but they can't find any kind of negligence. I mean, they can't even find where he has done something that they can twist in some way to make it look as if Daniel has been sleeping on the job or has neglected something. I mean, they can't find anything, any ground of accusation against him. And they know the reason why. It says in verse 5, "Then these men said, 'We shall not find any ground of accusation against this Daniel unless we find it against him with regard to the law of his God.'" They knew his why. Now, I want you to think a little more carefully about what that means that they know about Daniel. They know that the only way to bring Daniel into disfavor with Darius the king is if they can somehow create a situation where Daniel's service to God is in conflict with Daniel's service to the king. The only way that they can get Daniel out of the way is if they can create a situation where Daniel is put in a position where he has to choose between the government and his God, where he has to choose between the king and his God, where he has to choose between his life and his God. Because you know what they know about Daniel is if Daniel is put in a situation where he has to choose between God and the king, he's going to choose God every time. And if he's put in a situation where he has to choose between his job and his God, he's going to choose God. And if he's put in a predicament where he has to choose between his life and his God, they know that he's going to choose God every time. And note that if that is not true about Daniel, their plan will not work. This whole scheme relies on their confidence that Daniel will not let anything stand between him and his God. That Daniel will never compromise his devotion to God. And so everything is counting on that unwavering conviction in Daniel. That why behind what he does. He is the man that he is because of who his God is. Do people know that about me? Do they know that about you? Do your neighbors know your why? Does your boss know your why? Do the people that you work with and go to school with and play on the team with and the people you have coffee with, I mean, do they know your why? And shouldn't they? Is that not a mark of uncompromising devotion? Is that people know our why? Does your wife know? Do your kids know? Do they know your why? Daniel's enemies knew his why. And their plan all relies on that. I realize that King Darius is a bit gullible and naive in what happens here when these commissioners and these satraps come to him and they propose this law, this injunction that they want to put in place. But I do want you to know that this plot of their part was very carefully contrived. First of all, there was this deception. It says in verse 7 of the text, when they come to King Darius and they say, King Darius, live forever. They say, all the commissioners of the kingdom, the prefects and the satraps, the high officials and the governors, they've all consulted together. We've had this council. We've all been talking about this. And we've come to this conclusion that this would be something that would be good for our nation. Now, how many satraps are there? There's 120. How many commissioners are there? There are three. And they say all of us. They're leaving somebody out of that mix. I mean, there couldn't be more than 119 that they've talked to, and they can't have talked to more than two of the commissioners, because we know that Daniel's not going to go along with this plan. And yet there's this deception on their part, as if everybody, this is unanimous approval, this policy that they want to put in place. And there's a bit of flattery in this intent of theirs as well, when they come before the king and they say, King Darius, live forever. And the whole point of this whole, ultimately the point is to get Daniel out of the way. But you see the flattery that takes place, that for a month we want to put in place this injunction that nobody's going to pray to anyone else, to any god or to any man except for you, O king. And so they're trying to puff up his pride. They're trying to appeal to him with flattery by what this plan is that they are proposing. And they put Darius in a bit of an embarrassing dilemma, because here are the men that he's appointed. Here is his cabinet. Here are the servants of his government. And they are seeking to do something that is showing their support for him as the ruler, him as the king. And they put him in a rather embarrassing dilemma that he would run the risk of disappointing those that are seeking to honor him in some way. And so there's that facet to this policy that they're seeking him to put into place. But the biggest thing that I want us to appreciate about their plot here is that really they have asked Darius to put in place something that I think that Darius would have understood as being a temporary and a harmless edict. A temporary and a harmless edict. What I mean by that is he had to have known what this is really about in terms of these superficial things. That this was all just empty flattery, empty praise. He didn't know what the motive was under the surface, that this was about Daniel. But what I mean by saying that this was a temporary and a harmless edict is that it was only going to be in place for a month. This wasn't going to be a policy forever. It was just going to be for 1 month. If anyone prayed to any god or man, that they would offer their praise to the king. But Darius might even think, like, who prays that often anyway? That a month is going to be that much of an interruption. And please note as well that the law didn't require that people pray to Darius. The law didn't say that you have to pray to Darius. It just said that if they prayed, that their prayer needed to be uttered to Darius. But think about this. I mean, how enforceable is a law like that? How enforceable is a law like that? I mean, how do you know who people are praying to? Unless they're making a spectacle of what they do. I mean, the only way that you're going to know, like, what people are doing in their homes, in privacy, who they might be praying to, is if you're going to spy on them. Which is exactly what they had in mind with Daniel. And so they put this policy in place, and I think that Darius doesn't really think that anybody, I don't think he expects that anybody's going to be fed to the lions. This is just something that's going to be in place for a little while, and it's going to appease his constituents, and then it's just going to go away. But here's what I admire so much about another thing that I admire so much about Daniel and how it is that he responds. I just want you to see how he's not disquieted at all. How there is no picketing. There is no outrage. There's no political maneuvering on Daniel's part at all in response to something that was a political policy that was put in place. Read with me, if you would, in verse 10, when it says that after King Darius signed the document, it said, when Daniel knew that the document was signed, he entered his house and he prayed. He had his windows open toward Jerusalem, and he continued kneeling on his knees 3 times a day, praying and giving thanks before his God. Here's another question I want you to ask that I hope gets at the heart of what I see in Daniel here. Do we have to be winning to trust that God will win? Do we have to be winning to trust that God will win? You know, it can be sometimes that it feels like in our service to God, it might look like in our service to God that we're losing and not winning. Can we still trust that God is going to win when that's the predicament we find ourselves in? Do you see that Daniel was content to just disappear, if that be God's purpose? That he didn't personally have to be the commissioner. He didn't personally have to be the satrap. He didn't personally have to be living to know that God is going to win. And so there is no, he doesn't go and, you know, look for an interview or have to be on camera or have to, you know, rally his constituents and go and storm the castle in order to be seen winning or in order to be seen strong. Or if his party loses or if he suffers personal loss, whatever it is, his hopes are not pinned on what happens to something that's material or something that's external. He trusts that God's purpose is going to prevail, whatever it looks like is happening. And do I have that kind of trust in God that when I look like a loser, when I feel like I'm losing, when I look like I'm losing, that I know that God is winning? And that's enough to just hang my hopes and my confidence on the fact that God's purpose is going to prevail. That's the kind of devotion that Daniel models for us here. We can be, when we find ourselves in difficult circumstances, you know, masters of a justification, of finding some way to like change our behavior so that it takes the pressure off, or so we can fit in, or so that my life can become more comfortable, or so that I can escape some kind of pain. And I've thought some just about Daniel and him knowing that this law has been put into place and a potential process of justification that a believer might entertain in their heart. Like, what do I do when now it's not legal for me to pray to God? What do I do if the law of the land says that I've got to pray to the president or pray to the king if I'm going to pray? Think about what alternatives Daniel might have entertained. He didn't, but think about it. I mean, why not, Daniel? Why not just wait a month? So, we can't pray in the month of March. We'll pray in April. It's just a month. Why not wait a month? I mean, I'm a prophet, Daniel, my reason. I matter to God. God cares about my life. He doesn't want me to be hurt. Why not just wait a month? Why not, Daniel, why not just pray in hiding? Like, why not go into your closet? Why not get under your bed? Why not seek some place where no one's going to see? Why not, Daniel, why not just pray less often? I mean, do you really need to pray 3 times a day? Why not pray once a week? Why pray like morning, noon, and night? I mean, why make it so obvious? Why not pray less often? Why not switch up the time of day? Why not, Daniel, just pray silently? I mean, how did these men know that Daniel was praying to Jehovah? Well, it's apparently because Daniel's habit of even private prayer to God was audible. And so when he prayed in his home, he prayed aloud so that they could be a witness to the fact that he was praying to God. He spoke aloud to God. And he wouldn't even change that habit. I mean, why not, Daniel? Why not just shut the windows? I mean, he didn't do anything to hide it. He opened the windows, and three times a day, he prayed aloud to God so that it was easy to catch him in the act of it. Now, he wasn't making a spectacle of it. He wasn't doing it on the street corners. He wasn't doing it right in a flagrant way in public. He was just doing it in his home. But he didn't change anything about the habit of his prayer. So here's another question for us. Do we look for loopholes when culture and conscience are in conflict? Do we look for loopholes when culture and conscience are in conflict? All of these are loopholes that Daniel might have looked for, justifications that he might have made to changing his practice. But Daniel, he didn't change a thing. He's not looking for loopholes, not looking for a way out. He doesn't need a way out because God's going to win. He knows that. And so when culture and conscience conflicts, then Daniel chooses conscience. He chooses to serve his God because his devotion is not compromising. But here's a question that I also want us to consider in terms of Daniel's practice here and this injunction, and that's this. Say Daniel didn't pray for a month. What law of Daniel's God would Daniel have violated if Daniel had not prayed three times a day with his windows open toward Jerusalem aloud? What if he didn't do that? What law would he have broken? Now, I just want you to get this about these men who plotted against Daniel. When they looked at Daniel's habits of prayer, his habits of devotion, when they knew the why behind what he did, they just assumed, I mean, they just took for granted that the only reason why somebody like Daniel, the only reason why somebody who was a servant of Jehovah, the only reason why they would pray three times a day with their windows open toward Jerusalem aloud was because they had to, was because there had to be some kind of law, some kind of requirement, some place where God spelled out, thou shalt do this. I mean, why else would somebody do that unless they had to do that, unless that was a requirement of their God? Oh, if they had known how they missed that, I mean, that they had really blown it, that they had assumed something that wasn't even something that God was required in some kind of explicit fashion of Daniel. They just made the assumption that that must have been a law. But where's the passage that commanded the Jews to practice that? There isn't one. Oh, there's the assumption everywhere that men of faith will pray. There's implied in loving the Lord our God with all our heart and our soul and our strength. I mean, there's the implication of that we're gonna rely on Him. But there's no law that commands this practice or this habit of Daniel. And I just want us to admire that kind of devotion. Here is Daniel willing to die, not for something that he has to do because God has commanded him to do it. This is something he does because he has to. Because that's how he relies on God. This is just who his God is. And this is how much he needs him, how much he loves him, that he would choose no other way. And so I want you to think about this for yourself. Are my spiritual habits a burden to me? Or are they a lifeline for me? Are spiritual habits a burden to me? Or are they a lifeline to me? Can't you see that for Daniel? I mean, talking to God is a lifeline. And it's more important that he talk to God now than ever. If you see, he sees that as the power to change the way the world is. That the biggest way for him to make a difference in like what is happening now, in the most powerful places in the world, in terms of at least the arm of flesh, that the way to make a difference in what's happening in our universe right now is to make our appeal to God who sits on the throne. And so he knows that his Father hears. He knows that God is alive. He knows that God is in control. And so where else would he turn but to the throne of God? Where else would he go? I want us to think about just our own habits of devotion. And do you talk to God because you have to talk to him? You have to talk to him about what's going on in your life and what's going on in the church and what's going on in your family and what's going on with your friends. And do you have to be in the Word? Not because you're in the Bible class and you want to be prepared. I mean, do we come to the Word because I need to be looking in the Word for what I need right now in my service to God, in my walk to God? I mean, do we come to the Word with that kind of hunger or appetite that this is, I need this. And I need God to help me with this. So that we're coming to the Word not because of something that's a have to, but something that's a need to, a want to. We must because we desire Him and thirst for Him. I fear that the devil might not need a king's edict in our time to reduce some of our people to prayerlessness. You know what does that? Just being busy. Just our playtime. Our tea time. Our ball games, our extracurriculars, our entertainment, our phones, our internet, so that there's just no need, no real reliance, no real appetite, because the devil just puts so many other things in our hands that there's just not that heart for it. And I fear that there can be too much compromise in our time, not just with matters of personal devotion, like prayer, like being in the Word, but even with matters of explicit commandments. We can just look for loopholes. Just want to understand what we have to do in our service to God and not really think about how great our God is and the kind of service that He's worthy of. There's no question, is there, about Daniel that that he's going to keep the Sabbath, that he's not going to defile himself with the king's dainties, he's going to eat what's clean, that he's going to do all the other things that are part of God's law and God's expectations, and that he's not going to see any of those things as a burden. He sees the command of God, the expectations of God, as being boundaries for him that are good as forming habits that then have led to even further habits in him, of things that he wants to do for God, needs to do for God, because he just needs God that much in his life. Then the king arose with the dawn at the break of day and went in haste to the lion's den. And when he had come near the den to Daniel, he cried out with a troubled voice. The king spoke and said to Daniel, "Daniel, servant of the living God, has your God, whom you constantly serve, been able to deliver you from the lions?" And then Daniel spoke to the king, "O king, live forever. My God sent his angel and shut the lions' mouths, and they have not harmed me, inasmuch as I was found innocent before him and also toward you. O king, I have committed no crime." Then the king was very pleased and gave orders for Daniel to be taken up out of the den. And so Daniel was taken up out of the den, and no injury whatever was to be found on him, because he had trusted in his God. And the king then gave orders, and they brought those men who had maliciously accused Daniel, and they cast them, their children and their wives, into the lion's den. And they had not reached the bottom of the den before the lions overpowered them and crushed all their bones. Now, I know that the story of Daniel in the lion's den is an extraordinary story. I know that what happens here when God shuts the mouths of the lions is, when the angel comes and does that and rescues Daniel, I mean, I know that that's extraordinary, but Daniel didn't know that was going to happen. He didn't know that. I mean, there was no promise. There was no guarantee. In fact, I expect that Daniel had prepared himself that this is it. This is the end. And he was, and if the lions had eaten him, do you see, that would not have been a law. I mean, that would not have been failure. That would have still been triumph. One way or the other, Daniel's God is going to be exalted by this. One way or the other, God is going to be victorious, either because Daniel is going to show by the giving of his life that his God is worthy of that kind of sacrifice, or he's going to do that, nevertheless show that by the fact that he's willing to die, and God is going to show how powerful and mighty he is by rescuing the one who's willing to die, because his God is that worthy. One way or the other, God is going to be exalted by what happens here. And this leads me to just the final question that I want us to consider when we think about our own devotion. Are we trying to show God, or are we trying to show man that we really believe? I mean, who is the audience for the way that I'm living, for the way that I'm thinking, for the way that I'm talking? Who am I seeking to impress? Do you see that Daniel is counting on God to see? Who else is going to know what's happening in the lion's den? Daniel is counting on God to see. You are worth this, God. You are worth this to me. I love you this much. I'm not afraid, because I know that you reign. I know that I can trust in you. When the doors are shut and there's just Daniel, and can you picture in your mind, like, that dark den and the stench of the lions and the sight of the bleached bones in the corner, and Daniel is just prepared that next he's going to meet God, if that be God's will. And then he's okay with that, because God is the one that he's trying to impress, not anyone that's around him. Uncompromising devotion. I say to you again that this story is not written here for our admiration. This story is written for our imitation. Is this a picture of a superhero faith? Or is this just the picture of faith? Is this story given to us because this is like a bar that we'll never reach? Or is this here because this is just what ordinary faith looks like in an extraordinary God? That this is just when people put their trust in Jehovah, this is just what that looks like. Do you believe in the living God? Have you surrendered your life to Him? I want to say to you that you need to show Him, give Him your all. Surrender your life to Him. Because He will not disappoint. He will not let you down. He will win. And those who put their confidence and who put their faith in Him will win with Him. Because our God is faithful. Won't you come to Him as together we stand and as we sing.
Lo, my cross may be.